Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And Fred was telling me how much he loved the MTBF and wish it was a more popular metric in reliability engineering applications.
Yeah. And you were flailing along with these arguments about how great it is. And if you, you know, look at this exception or that exception, or if you do it this way or that way. And I'm like, no, I've heard all that stuff before. And then you immediately come up with examples where, yeah, that's not true. The issue I have, Chris, with, and I ran into this weekend. The only reason we started talking about it and we started a conversation and I said, wait, we got to hit record.
Yeah.
We haven't done that in a while. We usually kind of sort out, oh, let's talk about that when we're restrained enough to wait until we hit record. So I mentioned to you that I was grading some finals for a class I teach at Maryland, University of Maryland. And one of the questions was, what's an example of when it's acceptable to use MTBF and when is it not? And it dawned on me that in the class, I didn't explain why I don't like MTBF very well and some of the issues with it. And one of the answers was, well, it's in all the textbooks, so that's what we use. Another one was, well, all the other, after the exam and I gave him feedback, this particular person only scored 2 points out of 10 on it. And they said, well, all of our classes, all of our professors use MTBF. So I thought that was okay. And on and on and on. And I'm like, no. So I need to add that lecture back into my course. It's just, the issue is, yes, I agree with you, Chris, that there are times and places that MTBF may be suitable. And in the class, I asked for when is a case where it would be, and I'm looking for is that it's the underlying distribution actually is a constant hazard rate, and the people that are using it understand it, that that's what it is and what it means. And what I run into is so much misunderstanding, even from master's and PhD students in reliability engineering and other professors and everybody else, that it's easy, it's convenient, everybody uses it. It's, and then we just completely misunderstand it to the worst example. And I think I've told you about this one before, is this guy says, well, we've never seen anything other than exponential distribution. I says, oh, really? He goes, of course, because we just assume it's exponential and then all of our data works out that way. Okay. Have you noticed that you really are in trouble with the reliability of the product you're making and that's why you called me? It's like, ah! So anyway, I think the fundamental issue is not the mathematics. It's the understanding and the misuse of it that's so rampant that leads so many people astray to make just horrible mistakes. Mm-hmm. So that's my rant on it for the moment. So I don't know. I'm gonna drink coffee.
Yeah, and I have to agree in that I haven't seen the MTBF used in a default correct way when it comes to decision making for reliability related stuff, whether it's trying to set servicing intervals or warranty. Trying to somehow define warranty reliability from the MTBF. In fact, there are standards that essentially say, hey, if you have an MTBF, assume that 10% of your things will have failed at 70% of the MTBF duration, then that's going to be your warranty period, or that's going to be your functional safety window, or what have you. And you go, that's just beyond wrong, especially when then the same standard forces you to go through all sorts of equation related purgatory after that ridiculous assumption.
It's that kind of stuff that I just don't get it. Well, one of the answers was, well, if we use MTBUR to derive the MTBF, then it's okay. Huh?
Okay.
So you take a specific class of what you call a failure and add those up, and then you say that that's an equivalent to MTBF. And it was, no, they're all bad. Another one was when a reason why you shouldn't use it is because people think it's a failure-free period. And when it actually is a failure-free period, then you can use MTBF. And so in their own answer, they contradicted themselves. And I,
right. I was going to say the first part of the answer was good.
I know. I was like, full marks there. Okay, I got that. Wait a second.
That's right. I mean, like the times where MTBF is okay to use is when it's, we talked about this, where the underlying model of time to failure has a constant hazard rate. And there's precious few examples where that is true at the system level.
Mm-hmm.
Your favorite example right now is a coffee mug, noting that ceramic tends to, if it's going to degrade, it's not going to degrade in our lifetimes, which means it's going to predominantly fail due to drops and things like that.
Well, then you quickly brought up then the dyes fade or, you know, you get stained or stuff like that. And you're like, depends on what you call failure. I like a good coffee ground, you know, color on the inside. What do you call it with cast iron? It's seasoning. It's seasoned. So the coffee doesn't stick as much when it's coating the inside. Right. Yeah.
And so that's a good example. I'd also argue that there are examples where specific failure modes or mechanisms can be modeled with a constant hazard rate, especially those which where your system fails if it's struck by a tornado or some sort of environmental thing.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter how old or young your system is. It's going to have a bad day when it gets hit by a tornado.
Yep.
And so those particular failure modes or mechanisms related to that are essentially occur at a constant hazard rate. But again, it's rare for that to be translated to the entire system. And if you're using that model, then you know why. So it's okay. Another scenario where it's okay to use the MTBF is where it's, you know, defining a probability distribution in conjunction with another parameter. So if you're using the MTBF along with a standard deviation to define, for example, a normal distribution, then again, the MTBF or the mean is an important part of defining that probability distribution. So, again, have at it.
Well, you can do log mean and go after the log normal distribution.
Right.
You know, the log MTBF, that'll confuse them.
You can define a log normal distribution with a mean and standard deviation. It's just an absolute, you know, ordeal to turn it back into the parameters that we often use to define the log normal distribution.
You know, that's one that I found. I've been going through my old articles and trying to clean up some of the grammar and making sure they add titles and categories. So just kind of clean up across the site. And I ran into an article, is how to calculate using the mean and standard deviation of your data. How do you calculate the log normal parameters? And it's actually a rather popular and often visited article on the site.
Really?
Yeah. And when I remember writing it, and I have to double check. I didn't look. This conversation brought it up. But there's two different standard practices of dealing with log normal. One is take all your data and apply the log to it, and then calculate mean and standard deviation the old-fashioned way, which is like what I did in the article. And another one is do the data first and then fit log normal parameters to it.
Mm-hmm.
And is this just a difference in authors' approaches, or somebody went to Miami and the other person went to Stanford to come up with parameters or ways to deal it? Or is it just they're equivalent at the end of the day? They're just different. And it's not always obvious.
They should be equivalent, but I mean, specifically about the log normal distribution, the easiest way to get parameters is to convert all your data transform it into the logarithmic space and then do what you just mentioned to get the mean and standard deviation.
Yeah.
But if for some reason you've done a test and you've thrown away all the data points, and the only thing that's left is the mean and the standard deviation of those data points, it is possible to derive those parameters. But that could be topic of another log normal distribution podcast.
But the idea is that, well, I remember was it something that you showed me, or maybe it was one of the other students, one of those other Australian folks, I think it was Oka, that there was this map of all these distributions and the different families, the exponential family and the it was like a normal, I don't know what the other family was called, and how they were related to each other in the transforms, how one converted to another, how one, like the normal and Poisson, you know, are associated. One can estimate the other in some circumstances. And it was a spider's nest of, God. We're diverging. And exponential was in there. It was in the exponential family. And it was really just kind of the genesis for all these other useful distributions. It's still there. And I don't know. I thought, you know, I've been getting great feedback over the years. People have enjoyed the website. Actually, somebody in Korea wanted some of the coffee mugs and stuff like that. And I helped arrange getting shipments of no MTBF logoed coffee mugs shipped over to Korea. And, you know, I know that the site and these routine rants have made progress, yet I'd still just so endemic. That's the frustrating part for me.
Well, let's keep going on our journey to try and talk about scenarios where it's okay to use the MTBF. We've covered it where it actually models something which has a constant hazard rate, where the device or the failure mode or mechanism isn't deteriorating with age. It's okay to use the MTBF if you have another parameter to more correctly define the underlying distribution. And the other one we talked about is when we're trying to work out how many spares you need for an admittedly large fleet of machines or devices, where the Poisson distribution is often used. And that is really closely related to the exponential distribution, because it also assumes a constant hazard rate. And in fact, the only parameter you need for the Poisson distribution or the exponential distribution is the mean time between failure.
Yeah.
And
so wait. You said you assume that it's exponential. Does the data actually support that it's exponential?
Right. So it doesn't as a rule, but we also know at the central limit theorem that the Poisson distribution, regardless of the underlying distribution, when you're talking about a large number of failures in regard to whatever interval you're looking at, when you're talking about 30, the originating underlying distribution almost certainly disappears with the central limit theorem. So
doesn't that make it more normal-ish, not exponential-ish?
No, the Poisson distribution models, I mean, you just talked about it. The Poisson distribution tends to look like a bell curve or a normal distribution when the number of random variables are high.
Right.
But the Poisson distribution, by definition, the times between events or the duration between events are exponential. It just so happens when you add lots of exponential random variables together, like any other random variable.
It gets like a bell shape curve.
Right.
I get that.
Yep.
Now, the issue I have is that as soon as you do that, then the entire organization says, oh, MTBF's good. We'll use that for everything.
Oh, I know that. I concur. I'm not challenging that bit.
Okay.
I am saying that it's statistically, it's quite, I'd argue that you can more than happily use the MTBF when you're modeling the number of spares you need. Typically you're looking at 30 plus spares per year or per month or per quarter or whatever the interval is. If it's three spares, then you are almost certainly going to overestimate the number of spares you need and lose money and incur warehousing costs because
things don't math right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, the hard part for me is that in the mathematics, there's fine lines when it's okay or not okay, when it's good enough or not good enough. And you've gotten to the trouble in a webinar to show, you know, this doesn't work when you make those assumptions. And here's how much it'll cost you versus, you know, if a scenario where you've got a large fleet and you're going through dozens of alternators per day. Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. And your fleets of various ages and the alternators are being replaced on a regular basis. Now, is that related to Drenick's theorem?
I must confess, I don't recall that one right now.
Yeah, but I'm trying to remember the details of it. It was a part of a podcast where the concept was that you have like a battleship or a very large complex system, and it will default, it'll go to a constant hazard rate. And it's because there's many, many, many parts and all in their own variations. And the over time it will become a constant hazard rate. Well, the trouble is that, I mean, I think nuclear subs go under water for 9 month missions or stuff like that. And that's not long enough for it to, the theory says, well, after 30 or 40 years, this large complex system that where you're repairing things upon failure, and only repairing things on failure, then it will tend towards a constant hazard rate as an overall system. But it takes an exceedingly long time for that to occur. And most often we don't, for important systems, we don't wait for failures to occur to repair them. We do maintenance, we do repairs and refurbishments, and on aircraft, that's actually a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like that.
Yeah, and that's actually a valid, at least statistical concept where essentially once it's been used long enough and things have been failing and being repaired, essentially every single component you walk up to, you know, the next machine or the next vehicle or the next device, all the components are essentially equally likely to be old or young or new or anything in between. At the start of the life of that system, obviously every single component is brand new, so you can't that assumption doesn't hold. So
trust your manufacturer, you know, they might be putting counterfeit parts in or bad old parts from their original model, but I digress. But you're right. Yeah. It's at the start, it's new. And if you got a helicopter, I heard helicopters described one time as 10,000 loosely affiliated objects flying through the air.
They are remarkable machines, to be honest, helicopters.
But as you're replacing different parts and repairing, replace, you know, stuff like that, and it's been in the service for 10, 20 years, and I've parachuted once in my lifetime out of helicopters. I was glad I had a parachute on, sitting in the back of this thing, and hydraulic fluid was leaking on me, and a screw backed out of the panel and dropped on me. And everybody on the flight had that experience. And so we were rather happy to run off the back ramp of this thing. Just get out of here. Luckily, we were up in the air high enough that it was fun. But it was...
Yeah.
But over time, just about everything on that helicopter is going to get replaced. And so it becomes this random mix of competing failure mechanisms that individually the failure mechanisms are wearing out or degrading or something like that, but they, or just because of the harsh environment, if you don't put enough torque on that screw, it's going to come loose, and that's an infant mortality ish type thing, you know? And so it's such a mishmash that it looks normal.
Right.
The hard part for me is that people have taken that theory or theorem and
you mean it looks exponential.
Yeah, it looks exponential at a macro level, at the overall system level. But for the individual alternator or rotors or whatever, it's not.
Yep.
And that distinction gets lost. People go, oh, MTBF works for this. All right, it works for the rotors. It works for the engines. It works for the transducers and the nav system. They're all exponential. No, that's not true. And there's so many different ways that people have latched on, well, it must be okay, that, and it's so prevalent in the literature that, well, it must be good because everybody talks about it. And then that I call it a vicious circle, just keeps it going. And I don't know. It's enough of a rant, I suppose, for today.
it's actually a fair enough behavioral reaction. When you first step into a new domain, a lot of people who start off their careers as engineers that are chemical or electrical or mechanical, and they say, well, someone says, well done. From now on, you're going to be a reliability guy. Go off and turn yourself into a reliability engineer, and you open a textbook, and there's MTBFs everywhere. I mean, you can be forgiven if that's your first inference that MTBF is kind of a big deal when it comes to reliability.
Yep. Now, and that's the part that I haven't been successful with, is there's the IEC standards for the durability or dependability set of standards as pretty much over the last 15 years moved away from MTBF and MTTF and all that kind of stuff. They don't rely on those calculations. They don't include it. They don't use the terminology. And good for them. And that's been ongoing, and I certainly encourage it. Yet there's the safety standards I think you talked about that in one of the old ones. You know, they said, use the MTTF values and fit rates and calculate it up. And
it's not an old standard.
It's a new standard.
It just says, okay, when you get your MTBF, assume that, again, 90% of the things will still be working at 70% of your MTBF value, and go and make lots of multi-million-dollar life-changing decisions based on this complete pluck of a premise. And it's just not cool.
Not cool. So there's still work to be done. So I think the takeaway here, Chris, is that it was eye-opening for me, the responses from my – these are graduate students and talking about MTBF, and I realized I did a disservice to them. I didn't give them enough information to be savvy about this or educated about it or aware of the issues here and be able to articulate it clearly. So I owe them a follow-up. But the other part is how far we have to go. And I think your last notion is that when you go to school and the books are all on this and the professors are using exponential and your first excitement as a reliability engineer is all based on MTBF. Yeah, I get it. It's part of it, but it's also, it didn't take me long and I'm not that smart. So this doesn't make sense. And so it's, you can't check your brain at the door here, guys, just because it's always being done that way. We still have to think. So I think the wake-up call for me was this responses on this test I was giving. There's still, we got to keep at it and keep questioning and keep asking questions and keep doing a better job than just making blanket assumptions.
Yeah, so. I fully concur. I'm not sure what the answer is. I will throw in one more scenario where I'd argue it's okay. If you think you're doing like an Arrhenius plot where you're doing accelerated live testing and you're comparing, I'm looking at an example on my screen right now for a course I'm doing where you're comparing two different types of rubber and you increase the temperature and the Arrhenius plot allows you to say, okay, so for the for this type of rubber, it has an expected 1600 year life at 40 degrees Celsius. And this other rubber over here has a 170-year life or expected life at 40 degrees Celsius. They're both realistically analogous to the MTBF or MTTF for each one of those rubbers.
Yeah, but you got to say that, are the slopes the same?
No, in this example, the slopes are the same. So right. You can, but what that is they're the means of what we, if you scratch the surface, they become the means of what will be a normally distributed random variable because chemical reactions occur at a uniform rate as a rule. And so for comparing the two rubbers, if they cost the same and everything else, you go up at one which has a 1600 year characteristic life.
Yeah, I would always, always, always check that the slopes are the same and it's not just assumed to be the same. It's I've gotten caught out way too many times where somebody says, well, we can just compare the means, but the standard deviations were completely off or the slopes were completely off. And so in the time frame that we're interested in, the shorter mean life one was actually better, you know, and vice versa. It was just, it's not trivial like that, just going, well, yeah, it's a chemical reaction. And it may be totally valid all the way through, but please check.
But that's what but accelerated live testing, I mean, at least when you do it properly, involves that inherent check where you have, you know, at least three or four higher temperature values that help you create that slope that gives you those acceleration factors. So on the premise that you've done that correctly, you will get those characteristic lives, which can help you really quickly and easily just discern which rubber you're going to use in your design solution or operational situation.
I agree,
but it's an underlying understanding of what's going on, I should say. It's not just a number,
and that's really where I come down on it, is I've said it about 15 times in this presentation or this discussion. So, I mean, if you're listening to this and you're going, what are you talking about? Go over to nomtbf.com and see my total rant on this stuff and many, many articles and all kinds of cool stuff. And you can buy a mug there too, by the way, through Cafe Press. And they don't ship to South Korea for some reason.
Huh.
But so whatever. But anyway, the idea here is that, you know, we keep coming back to this topic on occasion through this podcast, and I think it's reinforcing just this idea that you need to think about it. So if you're listening to this and you know, you've got a good story about how you've made progress of convincing people not to use MTBF or MTTF or assuming a hazard rate when it's not really justified, I'd love to hear some success stories on that. That keeps me going. And if you've got a particular question or concern or whatever, if we're bringing this stuff up, you know, let us know. And for Chris, for your point of view is, you know, if you've got a good example where it's okay, you know, I'll listen, probably come up with some exceptions, but you know, I'll listen. So head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and you can find a SpeakPipe widget there that you can record us a voice message, basically, and we can actually include you in the conversation, or you can leave us a written comment. You can find Chris and I and the other hosts of the show over on LinkedIn or on our About pages on Ascendo. So lots of ways you can join us in this conversation. So I don't know. I have to get some more coffee or something, Chris. I just to calm down. Talking
in
about
a coffee MTBF. Mug that has a constant hazard rate, which right. can be modeled with an MTBF. Is that right? That's the ultimate irony.
Yeah.
That's the ultimate irony. The only thing that you believe can be modeled with an MTBF is the only piece of merchandise you sell on your no MTBF website.
It's not the only piece I sell. I also sell earrings. There's actually you can get T-shirts and earrings, all kinds of weird stuff on there.
Okay. Yeah, well, that coffee mug is your flagship piece of merchandise.
That's it.
And it's the only thing you believe actually can be modeled with the MTBF and nothing else.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, now you caught me off. I'm going back to bed. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Sorry to burst that bubble.
Talk to you later.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.